Good evening and welcome. I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it, or even creating it. Tonight, I'll be speaking with Shailen Blaney about JAMS, Journeying Across Musical Scenes, the University of Redlands organization open to the public. Also, Matt Gillum looks at UC Riverside STEM research, which brings into play Elmo, Sid the Science Kid, and more from the world of PBS. Taria Smith speaks with Jolie Proudfit about a Native American film festival coming up in November. That's all just ahead. First, though, let's go to John Sheldon in conversation with Tom Bryant, director of theater at Crafton Hills College.
Most of my professional career has been spent being either a director or what's called a dramaturg. A dramaturg is someone who guides the development of new plays, and currently I'm involved with a show called All the Way, which is concerning Lyndon Johnson's presidency and the civil rights movement. And this is currently at American Repertory Theater at Harvard University, and the playwright is Robert Schenken. I'm working as dramaturg. And the director is Bill Rauch, who's the head of Oregon Shakespeare. And we premiered this last year at Oregon Shakespeare, and last Friday it was announced it's going to Broadway. Bryan Cranston from most recently of Breaking Bad is doing the role of Lyndon Baines Johnson in the show. Anyway, that's an example of the kind of professional work I do in theater, which is working on the development of new plays. This particular process has taken 3 years. Crafton, essentially, I'm the only full-time teacher here at Crafton, and we have a huge amount of theatrical activity here. My philosophy has been that because I'm only one teacher here, I wanted to do a lot of stuff involving the students directing and producing their shows, their own shows, as a way of giving much more opportunity for activity, because I, as just one person, can only be kind of split a few ways. So a lot of our production schedule is tons of shows. Most of them are student-directed and of a huge variety of kinds of shows. We do improv shows. We do small cast dramas. We do musical reviews. We do dance productions for a while in conjunction with University of Redlands. We were producing operas, an opera every year with them. So there's a tremendous amount of activity going on. This has borne some really good fruit. A lot of our students are coming out of here going to really excellent schools in the area like Cal State Fullerton, UC San Diego, UCLA. One of our students, Anna Grozdanski, went to UCLA, is now back here teaching. Our students develop a tremendous work ethic as a result of the kind of work we do here. They do so many shows that they become quite skilled in a variety of positions, directing, acting, design work, technical theater work. So by the time they come out of here, you know, you'll see like 10 or 12 credits on their resume. They're also trained to take huge amounts of responsibility for publicity, for directing, or essentially stage managing and producing these shows. As a result, they come out of here as very kind of go-to kind of people who are really well organized and have great work ethic. So I think that's probably the hallmark of what we do. December 6th, 7th, 8th, we have something really kind of amazing that is very family-friendly and will be fun for the whole family. On our staff here at the college, he was a student and now he's teaching, Lucas Manning. And this is somebody who trained with ABT, American Ballet Theater, and is extremely talented as a choreographer. One of our more talented theater students, Jessica Ackerson, who in the past co-directed Laramie Project, as well as Rabbit Hole by David Lindsay Abaire, Jessica and Lucas kind of banded together, and they're doing an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. They're doing it as kind of a dance-slash-kind-of-musical kind of theater piece. In other words, it's a very fluid, theatricalized production. It's kind of more contemporaneous and more fantasy-based as opposed to literal Alice in Wonderland. But it's still the same characters, the same material, but with a kind of fantastic kind of dance explosion kind of treatment. That's December 6th, 7th, and 8th, which is Friday, Saturday, and the Sunday is a matinee. It should be fun for the whole family, and Lucas in the past has done really amazing dynamic dance work, and Jessica has directed some truly wonderful dramatic pieces.
Yeah, I'm actually really good friends with Lucas, and I've talked to him.
Oh, do you know Lucas?
Yes, I do.
Wow.
I tutored with him at Crafton in the tutoring center.
That's right. He's also a math genius, from what I understand.
Yeah, I'm really jealous of him of that.
then you know what a wonderful talent he is.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. We actually kind of talked about his Alice in Wonderland show and that him and Jessica are producing and directing. It's kind of like a dance show with a narrative is kind of what we narrowed it down to.
Anyway, I'm looking so much forward to this. This, again, is kind of what I'm most proud of in the program. You know, two talented people like that take the initiative to create their own show. Because from what I know about professional theater, that's really how you succeed. You don't wait around for someone else to cast you. You take the initiative and create pieces yourself. And I just love their creativity and energy and the quality of their work. Probably the best example of the kind of thing I'm talking about here.
And it truly is amazing because I remember I was taking a class with Lucas, and I remember halfway through our spring semester, he started talking about it. He was like, hey, you're an English literature major. What do you have a take of Alice in Wonderland and some of the ideas that they're trying to present? And we kind of just started generating ideas from that. It really shows from the people in your program that they come out and take this initiative by looking at other people in different majors or different areas that think differently than them and asking opinions and getting ideas from that.
We also, you know, at Crafton, we do a lot of work with the EMS, EMT, and fire programs. Those are really big programs on the Crafton campus. And so, for instance, we do stuff like we did a hazmat exercise with the fire department. Now, every year, they go down where Norton Air Force Base used to be, and they have kind of a hazmat area there where they train firefighters. They do a specific exercise where they set a school bus on fire. I mean, it's kind of faked. And then the fire cadets have to respond as if they were going to the scene of this terrible auto crash. And our students play the people who are injured in the bus crash, and they have to simulate different injury conditions and things of this nature. And we also do that in conjunction with the paramedic program and the emergency medicine technician program, where our students simulate patient conditions and stuff like that. So this kind of outreach to different people on campus, different programs, is part of something we've encouraged a lot. There also were collaborations with the art program and the music program as well.
Have you guys started about what next season shows will be?
Oh, great question. Yeah, one of the productions we're doing is by Ensasaki Shange, which is called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And this is Ms. Shange refers to this as a choreo poem. Now, this is a very famous show that was in 1976 and prefigures the entire spoken word movement in theater and in rap. Essentially, what these are is it's seven African-American women relating their experience through a series of kind of poetic, speech-oriented, dramatic monologues. And then in between, there's all this dance ensemble work with each other that kind of gets choral in nature, them all talking together in a kind of intricate kind of spoken word choral fashion. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah.
This is a landmark piece in the night. It played all over the country. It was originally developed at Joe Papp's Public Theater in New York. So we're doing that. We're doing a dance production. We have a new choreographer coming on board who will be doing a dance show. We haven't done the final scheduling on this stuff yet, but those are two pieces that are coming up. We are also doing an improv show in February. Colleague of mine, Steve Bean, you've probably seen his face on many television commercials. He used to be with the Groundlings in L.A., so he's kind of an expert in improv. Every year we do an improv show in the spring, early February, and they'll be putting on an evening of spontaneous improv here at the college. So those three shows are planned for the upcoming spring semester.
Now, are those productions and everything open to the public where they can come in and audition?
Basically, what we draw from in terms of the shows here are Crafton students. Now, somebody from the community, if they register for the class, can become part of these. Part of the reason for this has to do with, regulations of college classes now, where what they mainly want are people being enrolled in the program in order to participate in the shows. Somebody from the community, though, if they registered for the class, sure, could be part of it. you know, our class, there are several classes which are the, quote, production classes, unquote. You pretty much, for insurance purposes as well, have to be enrolled in the college in order to participate in the productions.
And these productions are open to the public to come as patrons. That was John Sheldon in conversation with Tom Bryant about the upcoming season and more for the Crafton Hills College Theater Department. I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it, or in this case, even creating it. Later in the program, Taria Smith speaks with Jolie Proudfit about a Native American film festival coming up in November. Also, I'll be speaking to Shaylin Blaney about JAMS, Journeying Across Musical Scenes, a University of Redlands organization that is open to the public. And Matt Gillum looks at UC Riverside STEM Research, which is looking at some of the very same PBS kids show characters you can see on KVCR-TV. That's all just ahead.
This is 91.9 KVCR. I'm Jessica James with a look at what's going on in our region. It's bilingual story time for children of all ages at the A.K. Smiley Public Library in Redlands, with stories in both English and Spanish. Story time is at 10:15 to 10:45 Saturday mornings. It's the Loma Linda Farmers Market, most Sunday mornings from 8 till noon. The Farmers Market is located on the Barton Frontage Road between Loma Linda Drive and Benton Street, just across Barton Road from the Stater Brothers Shopping Center. And it's Village Fest every Thursday evening in the heart of downtown Palm Springs. Each block offering street entertainment, art, handicraft items, food, and more. And along with that, enjoy free admission to the Palm Springs Art Museum every Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m. during the downtown Village Fest. Free admission is also offered on the second Sunday of each month. This is 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcr.org.
Later on KBC Arts, from First Nations Experience, Taria Smith speaks with Jolie Proudfit about a Native American film festival coming up in November. Matt Gillum looks at UC Riverside STEM Research, which looks at some of the same PBS kids show characters you can see on KBCR-TV. First, though, let's go to a conversation I had recently about a university club open to the public. That's at University of Redlands, and it's a club devoted to sharing music that might be outside of your zone. Have in studio with us Shaylin Blaney. And Shaylin, first of all, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
And we're here to talk to you about JAMS, a club at the University of Redlands. But first, JAMS, it's an acronym. So tell us what the acronym is, and that'll almost tell us what the club is.
JAMS stands for Journeying Across Musical Scenes. It's a club at the university that is dedicated to exploring different genres of music, even ones that may be outside of your comfort level.
How long has this club even been around? This is actually news to me.
So it's quite a baby at the university. It's only about 2 years old as of now.
You were around then for pretty much its onset. Why was this club started? Why get something like this going?
So there was a guy in Johnston who's abroad currently. His name's Hans von Sinkernagel, and he's really, really passionate about all different types of music. So he was interested in getting a group of people together to have a music appreciation club that was dedicated to appreciating all of the types of music. And I showed up to maybe the second or third meeting and fell in love immediately.
You became one of the officers very soon, or one of the leaders.
Basically, after the first meeting, I went up to Hans and said, "Your passion inspired me and I want to be a part of this. What can I do to help?"
Well, and meet the next vice president right there. So tell us about the meetings or what goes on at the club functions.
The meeting happens once a week, and we choose a genre of music. For example, we've had jazz, hip-hop, funk, grunge, punk, any type of music. We encourage the club to post their favorite songs on our Facebook page so that we can explore music that other people like that maybe is a little bit different than what you expected the genre to be like. And then at the next meeting after that, we have a guru who explains maybe the history and background of how the genre began or its influences in other genres. We have a discussion about it afterwards.
Interesting. That's really cool. And so these gurus, they could be another student who just has a passion for the music, or do you bring in professors, area professionals?
Because it's a student-run club, we generally rely on our members to volunteer for ones that they're particularly passionate about or ones that they have no idea that they want to explore further We have, however, had people come in from the greater university who are experienced in maybe DJing, or kids from the School of Music that are really experienced in jazz, and they know how to tell us about the musical details of the genre.
All right. Another big part of this, I suppose, would have to be the social media.
Yes. Facebook is basically what I think as the glue of our club. It holds us together. For the people who don't even come to the meetings, they're able to participate weekly just by posting their songs on the Facebook.
Is this a group page then, like a community page on Facebook, or is it a whole bunch of individual friends linked up in this way? How does this one work for you guys?
So at our interest meeting, I gathered people's emails, phone numbers, and their Facebook names so that I could go on their Facebook and add new members of the club. It's open for the public to view, but in order to post on the site, you have to be added. But constantly we get requests, and I like to add as many people as we can so we can reach a greater audience.
If people can't make the club due to physical limitations, or they just simply can't get out, they can still be a part of this and still learn and appreciate, which is, that's the basis for this, yeah?
Exactly. We wanted to touch as many people as possible and people who maybe aren't ready to sit down and talk about it yet.
It's a university club started by a Johnston student that's within the University of Redlands, but it's open to the rest of the university, I'm sure. Is this type of thing open to the general public?
Yes, it is. That actually depends on each club's individual charters. And JAMS is open to anybody who wants to join, including Redlands students, faculty, and community members.
You guys have reached out in certain ways in the community. An organization in Redlands also. Haven't you guys done some work with it at some point?
Yeah. Our founder, Hans, was really interested in how music touches us and how music can also touch other people into the community. He was really interested in doing some volunteer work at a place called Music Changing Lives in Redlands. It's at the community center, and it's a program that is geared toward underprivileged kids in the community who are interested in pursuing music or at least learning more about music. They offer classes, lessons. There's a small studio where if kids who have good enough grades, they're allowed to record some of their own personal music, which is awesome.
Wow.
JAMS has actually volunteered at MCL. It's a great experience for us. We took our idea of our meeting and turned it into a presentation that would be kid-friendly. So we took one, a genre, hip-hop, that we thought might be accessible and well-liked by the kids, and made a presentation of the beginnings of hip-hop and where it came from and how it's morphed into what it is today. And they really liked it. It was a lot of fun.
That would be something that I think a lot of people would be interested in and in tune with. Here today.
Well, sign your kids up and look for JAMS when you come back.
Got that right. So JAMS has done some volunteer with Music Changing Lives. What are some of the other presences that maybe the community has felt from this club?
We've done a lot of stuff on campus. I have been really dedicated in my presidency to doing at least one outside event every month. And it ranges from music documentary screenings or movies about musicians. We've done open mics that we hold in the Johnson Center. We have been really interested in hosting concerts and festivals that we maybe bring in people from the outside community so they can get some more attention maybe within the university.
Nice. It's a great way to help out area musicians as well as educating the students that are involved. Well, let's look at the future of the club. Where would you like to see it go? It's still in its infancy, but it's already doing some good things. What do you want to see happen?
As of now, I'm really interested in gathering a bigger base for our meetings because we have such great conversations, and if there are more people involved, they could go in so many incredible places. So that's my main goal for this upcoming school year. But as far as a major goal for next year, I'm really looking forward to hosting this festival and working toward a final product next spring.
Someone listening to this right now, how can someone find out more? Do you have a website or the Facebook page?
In addition to our Facebook page, we also have a blog. Our vice president, Ellen Johnson, she is incredibly tech savvy and has a great Tumblr for us. It's called musicisinfinite.tumblr. When we have our music genres every week, we post all of our favorite top 10 on our blog every semester.
Yeah. Okay.
And we also put the synopsis that maybe the guru was talking about up there. So people who missed the meetings can go back and maybe explore it just as easy as we did in the meeting.
A bit of a brief review as well as examples of what pertains to that review.
Exactly.
Okay, so again, the name of the Tumblr site, please?
Musicisinfinite.tumblr.
And the Facebook site, or if somebody just goes to Facebook, what do they need to search for to get to this?
You should search for JAMS as an acronym, so there's a period in between every letter.
J period, A period, M period, S period. Okay. And again, that's an acronym for?
journeying across musical scenes.
Shailen Blaney, currently the president of JAMS, mm-hmm. and I thank you again so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That was KVCR's Shailen Blaney. Again, you can find JAMS and keep up with their activities on Facebook. Later on KVC Arts, from First Nations Experience, Taria Smith speaks with Jolie Proudfit about a Native American film festival coming up in November. Up next, Matt Gillum looks at UC Riverside STEM Research, which looks at some of the very same PBS kids show characters you can see on KVCR-TV. Matt recently spoke with UC Riverside Associate Professor of Psychology, Rebecca Rickerts, who's leading the study.
The way that this particular grant works, it's what's called a collaborative research grant through the National Science Foundation. And so, as you noted, UC Riverside receives a certain amount of the funding that's part of an overall larger grant that I'm working on, or I've been working on, with two other colleagues. The first is Ellen Wartella, who's at Northwestern University, and the second is Sandra Calvert, who's at Georgetown University. And as a group together, we've been examining for probably the past 5 to 10 years that I've been on the team, although they've been working together for longer, how educational media that's designed to help children learn, whether it actually does, and to what extent it can be used to help children learn. And so what we decided to do was, in November of 2009, we submitted a proposal that the three of us put together to examine essentially what's in this particular grant proposal, to look at how educational media can be used to boost children's STEM learning. So we submitted that proposal in 2009, and we received recommendations from a panel of people who look at these proposals. And based on those recommendations, we revised and resubmitted the proposal. And we received some further recommendations this past, I think it was May or June, and continued to respond to some of the requests of the organization. And in doing so, we developed a really remarkable project, I think, and so we were able to receive the funding from the National Science Foundation.
That's great. And I mean, just reading through the press release again, it sounds really interesting, especially as people form these relationships with, quote, media friends. They sort of rely on them and they become part of their everyday. Looking at how kids are being impacted when they are so open to being impacted by what's on there. Since this is about looking at specifically STEM applications for television, do you feel currently that there's some kind of bias towards the humanities going on in kids' television, or is it sort of a fair playing field? This is just to maybe flesh out ways to more clearly or more decidedly get STEM in there?
It's a really good question. I think it's a really important point, too. So although the purpose of this grant is specifically to look at STEM learning and learning of STEM content, I think it's certainly just as important that we promote young children's interest in art and music and reading and using their imagination. We also want to make sure to promote exposure to things like diversity and pro-social behaviors. And I think your question reflects one of the unfortunate outcomes of our country's reactions to news reports that our children and our adolescents are maybe behind a lot of the world in terms of performance on tests of STEM knowledge. And I think the reaction is that we've somehow come to dissociate STEM learning as a particular kind of learning that's somehow separate and disentangled from learning in general and learning, say, in the humanities or in art or in music. So we are particularly focused in this grant on learning scientific content, but actually I think one of the things that our approach can help us understand is not just about learning specific STEM content, for example, how to add numbers together or how to understand biological processes or how to understand different kinds of animals or any other kinds of STEM content that children might be exposed to, but really about how we can use things like, again, children's relationships with characters. If those characters are very excited about learning and they're excited about exploring their world, then what it's doing is it's really setting up a different kind of mentality for approaching the world and then specifically STEM education, as opposed to focusing too much specifically on STEM content.
Okay. You talked about characters right there. Do you have any in mind, or can you give me an idea? I mean, how can Elmo or Dora, as was the example, How can they sort of get kids more excited about STEM?
Yeah. So one of the things that these characters do, so one of my colleagues, Sandra Calvert at Georgetown University, is doing her research particularly on toddlers and younger children, and they're working particularly with Elmo. In the research that we're doing in my lab, we're looking a lot more at Dora and Diego and Sid from Sid the Science Kid and Gabrielle from Sid the Science Kid as well. What we're interested in there is whether, as children build relationships with characters, if we can use all that positive feelings that children get when they're interacting with characters. So one of the reasons we chose those two characters is that they tend to be ones that, when we ask kids, they tend to rank toward the top of the most popular characters that kids seem to like. And additionally, they're characters that incorporate into their shows the kinds of learning we're interested in testing children for, the different types of STEM kinds of learning that we're interested in.
Sid the Science Kid would hopefully be doing some STEM research.
He is. He is doing some STEM stuff. That's true. So what we're interested in is not just the way that the content itself is presented in these shows, but the fact that children really do like these characters and whether that plays a role in how well and when they learn from the characters. For example, want to be like the characters and want to emulate the kinds of things the characters do in their own lives, or whether they think the characters are trustworthy and have the kinds of information that kids could use in their everyday lives.
Okay. I have one more question. If you could tell me a little bit about the methodology you plan on using, I mean, how can you quantify these results? I mean, it seems like it would be a very long-term study if you were to take children who were exposed to this media and then, you know, maybe track them throughout their academic careers and see which ones ended up going into STEM versus humanities. So, I mean, how are you really going to be tracking this or looking at the data?
The kind of study we're doing is actually looking at a single discrete kind of point in time, essentially, and looking at not at exposure to media in a particular age range and then tracking through STEM interest in careers through adolescence and adulthood, as you described. That would be a very large longitudinal kind of undertaking. So what we're doing is we're specifically interested in the factors that relate to learning content and learning principles at a specific point in time. And so what we'll do, I have a research lab here at the University of California, Riverside, and it's set up basically like a living room. And so we bring in parents and kids, and they come visit us, and we have the kids watch different clips of different shows. You know, we ask them afterwards basically what they've learned from watching. We have some structured ways of testing whether they've learned the specific things we would think that they would learn from the different shows. And then we ask them all kinds of other questions about how much they like the characters and how much they want to be like the characters. We're also asking additional questions. One of the other things that's happening during these years is children are beginning to form their stereotypes about gender and ethnicity, as those might be related to different STEM concepts or careers. So we're also testing children on those kinds of things as well when they come in. But in this case, we're looking specifically at a single point in time. Are they learning the particular kinds of content from different characters that we would expect that they would be learning?
Okay. Your work really does sound fascinating to me, and I'm excited and interested to see how it's going to turn out.
I am too. I mean, we think we've got a handle on something, but you never know until you're able to really set it out and test it, like you said, and quantify it and really see if the kinds of things we think are going on are really what are actually happening.
You know, I guess the next step would be, once you get the information from a study like this, maybe you would have the research and the data to back up one of those really long-term longitudinal studies of tracking.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this particular project really is the first in what we anticipate to be a long sequence of studies that will build on each other depending on what we're finding and then where we're going. One of the other parts of this particular funding is to work from the research I just described. So as we're able to identify what types of features of characters are most likely to support children's learning, to work then from there on other studies examining building avatars, for example, in interactive games that could maybe help support children's learning in similar ways, and testing whether those kinds of principles that help children learn from television are also can be utilized in other forms of media as well. So there's a lot of things we have in mind for following up on this research.
Well, keep us posted.
I will do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking some time today to talk to me.
Thank you very much, too. I enjoyed speaking with you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
That was KVCR's Matt Gillum in conversation with UC Riverside Associate Professor of Psychology, Rebecca Rickards. Just ahead, from First Nations experience, Taria Smith speaks with Jolie Proudfit about a Native American film festival coming up in November. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. I hope to have a chance to meet you when I visit the Inland Empire. KVCR has invited you and me to the University of California, Riverside on Saturday, December 7th. At this special event, I'll share my experience working as a journalist and as the host of On Point. Please join me in December as together we support public radio, KVCR, where you learn something new every day. Event information is online at kvcr.org/events.
I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts. Thanks for joining us. Up next, from First Nations experience, Taria Smith lets us know about a really cool film festival coming up in the very near future.
I'm here with Professor Jolie Proudfit. She's the director of the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center at California State University at San Marcos. She's a descendant of the Pechanga Band of Liseño Indians and has a PhD in political science. She's joining me to talk about the very first San Diego American Indian Film Festival that's taking place November 21st through the 23rd. Can you talk about how the idea developed to start the American Indian Film Festival in San Diego?
Yes. The idea to have an American Indian Film Festival in the San Diego region came about after several years of bringing in American Indian films and filmmakers to our campus and realizing that we are getting a standing room only crowd, and the response from the tribal community is, when are you going to bring more films and more filmmakers? And also last year, I had students who attended the film festival in Los Angeles and spent the night at my house in Pasadena, and they were sleeping on every couch and available surface they could just to watch one film. And I just thought, what a shame for our students who are coming from tribes in the San Diego region and Riverside County, and they have to drive all this way just to watch one film by American Indian filmmakers and featuring American Indian actors. So why not bring these films that are for us, by us, to our tribal communities, especially where we have such a large population of tribal reservations and tribal communities?
Along with that, if you can elaborate a little bit more, San Diego County is the home of more reservations than any other county of the United States with such a large Native American population. Why do you think it's taken so long for such a film festival to be hosted in this area?
Well, I think, you know, coordinating a film festival is a pretty large undertaking, and I've had years of experience in working with folks in the industry. I was the former chair of American Indian Studies at San Francisco State in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, and my students would intern at the San Francisco American Indian Film Festival, which is one of the oldest American Indian film festivals in the country and a really well-run festival. So in working with Mike Smith and having my students intern there, and we had different activities and partnerships when I was chair of American Indian Studies there, I thought, let me bring some of my skill set, my colleagues, my connections to this region to coordinate an American Indian Film Festival that really features and highlights those films that portray American Indians as we are today, yesterday, and hopefully in the future, and not just focus on the negative stereotypes of your typical downtrodden reservation environment or just focus on alcoholism and the depressing side notes in many of our tribal communities, but to really talk about some of the positives and the good storytelling and share with people some of the animation that is happening in Indian country, some of the youth films that are happening in Indian country, but just the wide variety of storytelling. It's not just focused on one particular area. And so we want to make sure that we give a good cross representation of American Indians to the region. After, you know, being at this campus for 5 years and now having this California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center, which is a home base for much of the research that's happening around California Indians, I thought this is a good time to coordinate a film festival. And so I got buy-in from local tribal people and tribal leaders and filmmakers, both Indian and non-Indian, to come aboard and work with the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center to produce this inaugural American Indian Film Festival.
You had mentioned a little bit ago about the fact that it's a big undertaking. Can you talk about what some of the challenges were that you faced in putting this event together?
With pretty much most events, the biggest challenge is resources for putting this together. And so we've been pleased with the support that we are receiving, not only the financial contributions of people interested in supporting this endeavor and organizations, but the in-kind contributions by organizations such as On Native Ground, who are helping us with some of this undertaking, and our students who are actively participating, my students in my American Indian Media class, my course entitled Imagining Indians, American Indians, and Media, Film, and Society, are volunteering their time to put this on. So we're really excited that so many different groups are coming together to make this happen. And like I said, you know, no better place given the 18 reservations that exist in San Diego County alone, not to mention the numerous other reservations on the periphery in Riverside County. So although we're, you know, titling this the San Diego American Indian Film Festival, it should really be a film festival for Southern California and all the tribal communities in this region who normally don't get to go to big cities to watch these types of films. So it's a way to bring the films to them.
Who have been primary supporters along the way in helping you put this film festival together, not only monetarily, but people that have given in-kind contributions or people that have lent their time and effort into helping you put this together?
Well, we're working with a number of advisors in the industry who are assisting us. Here on this campus, we have an Office of Tribal Liaison, and she's been great in volunteering her time to work with us on this project. And like I said before, my students, both through the center, our American Indian students, and my non-Native students who are enrolled in classes are excited in volunteering their time. And we're working with American Indian, you know, media experts and filmmakers themselves, like Jack Kohler and Anacita Agustinas with On Native Ground. They've been great in helping us put this together. So we're just really excited and really blessed. And then we have, you know, community members like Larry Benegas from Verona, who's volunteering his time and effort to help put this event on. So we're really excited that the team of hands and people involved in this are from a variety of tribal communities and non-tribal communities.
How did you go about selecting the films that are being showcased, and how many films are you featuring?
We have an advisory committee of well-known American Indian filmmakers and individuals interested in this area who have helped peer review or review these films to select these films. And we're also bringing in films that we think tell a different tale and are films that our American Indian community folks here would be really interested in watching. And so because this is our inaugural year, our film festival is only 3 days long. We anticipate growing the festival in the future. But for the 3 days, we're going to be featuring The Cherokee Word for Water, the film about Wilma Mankiller. We're also going to be bringing the Star Wars film that has been done in the Navajo language. We're really excited about that. And we're also bringing Chasing Shakespeare, and Danny Glover is confirmed to be at our screening. So we're excited about those three features, and then we're bringing a number of shorts and youth films, as well as animated films and animated shorts. We're also going to be premiering a film about the San Luis Rey water struggle, and so we're really excited about that.
It's been said, I guess, on the other side, on the FNX side, when interviewing a lot of people, especially in the San Diego County area, that a lot of the population doesn't have a good familiarity with Native people, especially local tribes. And I was just wanting to find out, for people that aren't part of the community, that aren't part of the Native community, that come and want to see some of these films, what can they expect to, when they come to the festival, what can they expect to learn about, and what would you like for them to come away with after viewing the films?
Yeah, we're hoping with this film festival that we can reach a variety of audience, especially our non-Native community members here, to really educate them about American Indians, who we are, And we think that film is a really great way to do that. And given that this film festival is being brought to the community through the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center, we thought we were a great vessel in which to really bring the opportunity of educating non-Indians, as well as Indians, about the many issues in Indian country. You know, our films are going to address issues like language revitalization and tribal culture and showcasing the lives of American Indians, and provide for an opportunity for folks to engage in dialogue with tribal community members as well as filmmakers. So we think that this film festival will do a lot to create better understanding and a relationship building with the non-Indian and Indian communities, and to let people know that we're more than casinos. You know, we are a vibrant, culturally driven community with a variety of interests and issues and concerns, and if we can bring those issues to a larger community, I think that opens a dialogue and provides for partnerships and collaborations where there may have not been, just because there hasn't been an opportunity to invite folks to collaborate. So we're hoping that this film festival does more than just entertain people, but it serves as a vessel to educate, to collaborate, and to really bring together a variety of cultures and to bring together a level of understanding that may have not been there in the past.
You are a professor there at a university, and you do teach classes focusing on media and television and film. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in the way someone learns when they're watching a film about Native people as opposed to them reading historical accounts about Native people?
Everyone likes learning through a visual medium. And it offers variety to students. And while it's great that we have these wonderful Native American authors and writers and books, not everyone gets the opportunity to be exposed to taking an American Indian Studies class. So having an American Indian Film Festival offers the opportunity for visual learning and really whets the appetite of someone who wants to learn more. So if someone watches a film and says to themselves, well, I didn't know that, I would like to learn more, well, then the next step would be then to enroll in a class in American Indian Studies here on my campus or on another campus, but really to be better engaged and to really kind of whet the appetite of someone who's interested or maybe never thought they would be interested in American Indian culture, but maybe a film can pique someone's interest. So, you know, I've met a number of people throughout my life when I've asked them, you know, why are you doing this? Or why, you know, what piqued your interest to study this or research this? And they said, you know, when I was a kid, I saw a film about or watched a documentary on, or they watched a film and they decided to become a writer and offer a very honest and authentic portrayal about their own people. So I'm hoping that this film festival, you know, inspires Native people, but also non-Native people to learn more about American Indian populations from American Indian people themselves.
I know you mentioned earlier that you would like for the festival to be a few more days next year. Do you have any other plans and goals for next year's festival and looking at this one?
Yeah, our goal for this film festival is to grow the film festival so that there will be film screenings throughout the region as well as on Indian reservations throughout the region. So, you know, if we have a film festival that is 7 to 14 days, that is fine by me. This way we can give tribal community members who maybe are located in a great distance from an urban environment, we can bring maybe some film screenings to those communities and have people go out there so that they have an opportunity to visit a tribal community. That tribal community has an opportunity to be a part of a festival. And then people can also have an opportunity to see the diversity of our land and our culture and our community. So my goal is to expand this film festival, to have films running throughout the region in San Diego, in some of our tribal communities, in some of our urban environments, and some of our reservation environments.
Where can folks that are interested in going to the film festival get more information about when and where and all?
For folks who are interested in learning more about the film festival, they can visit our website, www.csusm.edu/AIR. AIR stands for American Indian Resources. From there, they can connect themselves to the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty website, and we can link them to our link that will list all the different films, the times that they're going to be offered, where to purchase tickets, our VIP reception, and our different activities and speakers associated with the film festival.
Thank you so much, Dr. Proudfit, for your time and for being so willing to do this interview with me. I really do appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, and I hope to see you soon.
This has been Taria Smith of First Nations Experience Television Network for KVC Arts. Back to you, Dave.
Thank you so much, Taria. And again, information about the film festival and much more at csusm.edu/AIR. That's American Indian Resources. That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks to Rebecca Rickards at UC Riverside, Jolie Proudfit at Cal State San Marcos, and Tom Bryant at Crafton Hills College. Here at KVCR, thanks to Jessica James, Shailen Blaney, Matt Gillum, Lindsay Weisgarver, John Sheldon, and Program Manager Rick Dulock. With FNX, that's First Nations Experience Television, thanks again to Taria Smith, and thanks also to contributing members who make programming possible on KVCR. A reminder, you can now get podcasts of KVC Arts, including tonight's, at our website, kvcr.org. All themes and beds, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to him as well. Matter of fact, Sean has a new release out, and let's go and close out this show with the title track from it, called On My Way. That's music from Sean Longstreet from his latest release called On My Way. As a matter of fact, we just heard the title cut. Thanks for listening. I'm David Fleming with you here at 91.9 KVCR San Bernardino Riverside, where you learn something new every day. Streaming online at kvcr.org. We are a service of the San Bernardino Community College District. Stay with us for an hour of On Point, then it's Science Friday. It's 9 o'clock.